Okay, let's unpack this. We are about to embark on a complex, but I think truly exhilarating deep dive.
I think so too.
The material we've gathered today isn't just about small iterative changes. It's a massive collection of technical talks, of deep architectural insights, covering the absolute cutting edge of cloud infrastructure.
Yeah, everything from database performance tuning all the way to, the future of software development
It
itself.
really feels foundational.
It is. It's a foundational look at the next wave. The changes we're analyzing, they're happening across infrastructure, development tools, security models, operations.
And they all seem to be pointing in one direction.
They are. They're all geared toward preparing the cloud for the single biggest technological shift happening right now.
And that shift is the age of agentic AI. So our mission today is pretty laser focused. We want to understand the architectural foundation required for this new era. We need to map out how the cloud, from the data layers all the way up to compute isolation, how it has to adapt to reliably support what the sources estimate will be billions of intelligence always on agents.
Billions in production systems worldwide.
It's a staggering number.
And we've synthesized insights straight from Redout Invent 2025. We're talking technical deep dives, focusing on the latest AI developer tooling, patterns for resilient operations, hyper-optimized data structures, and the absolute requirement for confidential computing.
So we're essentially looking at the blueprints.
The blueprints for autonomous decision-making systems that will soon manage, huge parts of our digital world.
That sounds like a lot of trust to place in code. Let's start with the agents themselves and how this new paradigm of development and operations is taking shape. So we've moved really quickly from the era of the large language model, the LLM, as a kind of sophisticated chatbot to the LLM as a sophisticated tool user. The source material really emphasizes that this agentic shift means moving far beyond simple single-turn conversational responses.
Absolutely. We're talking about systems designed to reason, to formulate a multi-step plan, and then to, act on that plan over extended sessions.
So they're not just answering a question and forgetting.
Not at all. They hold state, they access highly specialized external knowledge bases, and crucially, they use tools to interact with real-world infrastructure.
And that's the key.
That's the key. This is why the infrastructure supporting them has to be tremendously robust and optimized for extremely low latency.
And the sheer volume is, well, it's staggering. The projection that really caught my attention was the conservative estimate, over 1.3 billion AI agents in production by 2028.
And that's the low end.
If that's the low end, the infrastructure pressure is almost unimaginable.
It forces a complete reevaluation of operational practices. I mean, when you analyze where the highest value, highest demand applications for these agents are, they land squarely in the operations space.
So we're talking about.
The birth of the AI Site Reliability Engineering Agent, the AI SRE.
Okay.
Traditionally, human SREs are called upon to solve incidents, which is the most chaotic, stressful, and time-consuming part of the job.
Right, you're firefighting.
You are.
Ooh.
The AI SRE is moving beyond just simple monitoring and toward full AI-directed operations.
Most people struggle to visualize that jump, though. How does an AI SRE move past just detecting an anomaly and actually execute a nuanced remediation in a complex production environment?
It requires deep system integration. The AI SRE automates issue detection, of course, but the real power comes in accelerating the root cause analysis.
Instead of a human digging through logs.
Exactly. Instead of correlating fragmented data manually, the agent can instantly contextualize metrics, logs, and traces. The critical jump is its capability to recommend, and in many cases, execute remediations in real time.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, the sources gave a powerful, very common example related to the classic multi-tenant issue.
The notorious noisy neighbor problem, where one highly active user just ruins performance for everyone else.
Yes. So let's imagine a shared cloud environment. You have one customer, the sources call them the Eagle tenant, and they're running a massive flash sale that generates an enormous spike in traffic.
Okay.
This spike leads to resource contention, which shows up as rate-limiting issues in shared dependent services, like a core payment or a shipping API.
And a human SRE team. What's their typical response time?
Traditionally, they would take an hour, maybe more, just to manually correlate the logs, identify the source, understand the blast radius, and then execute a fix.
It's a chaotic scavenger hunt, like you said.
It is. The AI SRE changes this completely. Using real-time observability tools like OpenSearch, the agent identifies the rate-limiting problem, correctly attributes the issue to the Eagle tenant's workload by analyzing usage metrics.
And then the action.
And here's the automated part. It triggers and executes a scaling action. Perhaps it isolates that noisy tenant onto dedicated capacity or dynamically scales up the shared services rate limits.
And the time to fix.
The entire process moves from detection to resolution in minutes.
It effectively removes hours of manual high-stress correlation work.
Right. The agent can instantaneously synthesize data points that a human would have to pull from spreadsheets, from configuration management databases, you know, the CMDBs that track all the IT assets.
And all the disparate log aggregators.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That speed is transformative, but it also underscores a really important requirement. For the agent to act like an expert engineer, it needs deep, specialized knowledge.
It can't just be a generalist LLM.
No. This leads us directly to the architectural component that gives the agents their expertise, the multiple cooperative persona servers, MCPs.
Okay, let's define these. An MCP server isn't just a knowledge base. It seems to be the specialized mechanism that really shortens the agent's time to value.
Precisely. The MCP server is the agent's subject matter expertise layer. It gives the agent deep domain-specific knowledge about complex systems, like the entire AWS ecosystem, or specific APIs, or compliance frameworks.
So it drastically shortens the prototyping timeframe.
It does, because you don't have to attempt to train a giant general-purpose model on the minute, often highly technical, domain-specific details.
So instead of one massive brain that struggles to remember the syntax for both Python and Rust, you create specialized brains that only focus on one area.
Exactly. Specialization is the key to efficiency and accuracy. The sources gave really clear examples. You might have an AWS serverless MCP server that understands the serverless application model, or SAM, integration and best practices for deployment.
Or one for the CDK.
Right. An AWS CDK MCP server that is specifically trained on the cloud development kit and Python code generation patterns. This functional specialization allows the agent to access deep expertise instantly for the specific task it needs to execute.
Now, here's the interesting paradox the source has highlighted, the context challenge. Mm. Intuitively, a developer thinks, if I give the agent access to all the specialized knowledge, it will perform best. But the source material warns that too many MCP servers can actually make the agent dumber. Why is that?
It's a crucial architectural constraint, and it's governed by the LLM mechanism itself. Every MCP server and its associated tools, documents, and API specifications. They all add tokens to the agent's context window.
And tokens are the fundamental unit of information in the model processes.
Yes. So the larger the context window, the more expensive the LLM call becomes. But more critically, the agent suffers from what is called lost in the middle, or, you know, too much information syndrome.
So if an agent has to wade through 15 different highly technical tool specifications to decide which two are relevant for a task,
it increases the likelihood of hallucination or choosing a suboptimal path. The developer has to be prescriptive, curating only the MCP servers strictly necessary for the task at hand to maintain both agility and cost efficiency.
That means the success of agentic AI depends heavily on platform engineering teams adopting a platform mindset.
Yes.
Centralizing these tools, but also governing their access strategically to ensure they don't stifle the very agility they're supposed to enable.
And that strategic orchestration is absolutely necessary when we move from simple tasks to complex agent workflows, which rely on what's called the supervisor pattern.
Let's detail that orchestration, because this is where the system starts to act like a human projects manager, coordinating a team of specialized workers.
Right. So the agent itself is hosted in a secure, serverless environment known as the Agent Core Runtime. Any tools the agent might use, APIs, database connectors, or other MCP servers, are exposed via the Agent Core Gateway.
Okay.
Critically, this gateway uses semantic search to prevent that context overload before the request even hits the core LLM.
Ah, so it intelligently filters the available tools based on the user's natural language request.
It does.
That pre-filtering must save an enormous amount of cost and token space. And the supervisor agent acts as the overall manager.
Exactly. The supervisor manages the end-to-end orchestration of a complex task. The source detailed a really compelling case study, automated patching.
Which is typically a manual high-risk process.
Very. The process starts with a simple patching request submitted to the supervisor agent.
And what's fascinating is how many different specialists the supervisor coordinates. It's not just one agent doing everything.
No, it coordinates specialized agents like the vulnerability analyst, the compliance analyst, and the patch manager.
Okay, walk us through it.
First, the supervisor ensures the system has context. It uses EC2 tags and AWS config to retrieve all relevant configuration data and compliance frameworks, such as the requirements under PCI DSS.
The Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard.
Right. So it knows not just what the system is, but how it must behave to be compliant.
Got it. Mm.
Then the Vulnerability Analyst Agent consults systems like AWS Inspector to identify the presence and severity of vulnerabilities. The data flows back to the supervisor.
And then the Patch Manager steps in.
Then the Patch Manager agent performs the crucial analytical step. It determines, based on the severity of the vulnerability, that an SLA violation is imminent.
Give us the concrete timeline detail here. Why is this automated decision so critical?
Because a human might see that the default patching window is 24 days away and just schedule it for next month.
Seems reasonable.
But if the vulnerability is high severity, the PCI DSS requirement might mandate patching within 48 hours. The agent identifies this mismatch, a detail that's easily missed by a human juggling multiple compliance frameworks, and it automatically elevates the task.
It determines an emergency patching process is required.
Exactly. And it doesn't just execute a massive risky rollout. It understands risk mitigation.
It's not just patch everything now.
No. The supervisor initiates a phased rollout. Dev first, then staging, and finally production. At every stage, it integrates with automated health checks.
So it's moving beyond the fear and chaos of manually analyzing blast radius and exposure.
And it transforms a process that previously took human engineers hours, often under extreme duress, down to seconds of coordinated action.
This level of autonomy, though, it must bring up serious questions about governance and control. If an agent determines an emergency patch and initiates a phased rollout, where do the sources suggest the human steps in for verification?
That's the tension point. The sources stress that governance is provided by humans, but the intervention point shifts. You move from intervening at the point of execution
to intervening at the point of governance definition.
Exactly. For instance, the human engineer must define the SLA mismatch rules clearly within the compliance analyst agent's framework. The agent's decision is based on trusted, pre-approved rules, but the agent handles the complex data synthesis and execution.
So the human oversight is in the defining of the constraints, allowing the agent to operate safely within them. And reliability is ensured through continuous interaction, which the sources mentioned is made easier by the Strands SDK.
That's the core of the agentic loop. It's absolutely essential for building reliability into autonomous systems. If an LLM generates invalid parameters for an API call, which happens a lot, the Strands framework catches the exception. Instead of crashing, the framework feeds the error message and stack trace back to the LLM, prompting it to self-correct the parameter on the fly.
So the developer doesn't need to explicitly code a complex try-catch reformat block.
No, the agentic framework handles the error resilience.
This fundamentally changes how developers approach building applications. We are moving away from pointing and clicking and even immediately writing code to a world where we just describe what we want.
That is the role of the developer environment called Quiro. It's what enables the shift to describe and do.
Tell us more about Quiro and this spec-driven development methodology.
Quiro really champions the idea that documentation and planning should precede code generation. Instead of immediately writing code, the AI generates the requirements document and the design document first.
It lays out a comprehensive project plan.
It does, almost like a dynamic Gantt chart, detailing the project scope, the technical stack, security requirements, everything.
Why is generating the spec first so much better than immediately jumping into code?
It provides absolute clarity and drastically reduces what's called implementation drift.
An implementation drift. That's where the final product doesn't quite match the initial business intent because assumptions change or details got lost along the way.
Precisely. By forcing the AI to formalize the requirements, it aligns all the stakeholders, business analysts, security teams, developers, on the desired outcome before the first line of code is ever written.
And what happens when the requirements inevitably change? A change request comes in.
That's where the crucial feature of agent hooks comes into play. These are event-driven prompts that maintain synchronization.
Okay.
If a developer or a business analyst modifies a core document, say, they update the requirements.md file in the source repository, that change triggers an agent hook.
And the hook acts as a synchronization agent.
Exactly. The agent hook immediately summarizes the change and pushes that update back into external systems like Jira or a CMDB, updating the associated tickets and documentation automatically.
Wow. So this eliminates the data drift that makes governance and compliance a nightmare.
It does. It ensures the project plan, the compliance record, and the actual code all remain in sync.
That capability, the ability to reverse engineer and synchronize technical data with business intent, that's immense, especially for legacy projects.
It is. The sources noted that Quiro-based tools can analyze an existing, massive 800,000-line code base, detailing the language versions, libraries used, testing strategy, error handling.
And translate all that into governable steering documents.
Right. This makes legacy projects immediately legible and governable by the new generation of specialized agents. It turns decades of accumulated technical debt into structured data the supervisor agents can actually use.
The optimization for knowledge extraction and autonomous execution is clear across the entire development lifecycle. Okay, so if we are preparing for billions of agents, each reasoning, planning, and executing actions in real time, the data layer cannot be the bottleneck.
It just can't.
It requires predictable, hyperscale demand capacity.
That's the biggest architectural challenge. The underlying databases must be effortless. The architectural requirement for the agentic age is eliminating the need to plan, provision, and manually manage capacity.
So the mandate is
zero infrastructure to manage and virtually unlimited pay-as-you-go scalability.
How does that translate into the relational world, which has traditionally been tied to fixed capacity planning? Let's look at Aurora DSQL.
Aurora DSQL, which provides PostgreSQL compatibility, has fully embraced a serverless compute model. It's very similar to function as a service like Lambda.
So you only pay for what you use, down to the second.
You pay for compute seconds only when the database is actively processing a query. This is a crucial shift because it handles complex queries, joins, and aggregates without requiring you to provision hardware based on a projected peak usage that might only occur for a few hours a month.
This efficiency is paramount for cost, but when we have autonomous agents accessing this serverless database, security suddenly becomes much more complicated than a simple username and password.
Oh, security is critical, and DSQL solves this by tightly integrating identity management. It uses the standard PostgreSQL role system, but binds specific database roles directly to standard cloud identity mechanisms.
Specifically, IAM entities.
Yes. So instead of managing siloed database users, the administrator can manage access through existing organizational identity policies.
That's a huge deal for governance.
It is. This allows administrators to control read-write access at a highly granular level. They can dictate which IAM entity or which agent running under a specific IAM role can access which specific tables or schemas within the database. It enforces least privilege access across the entire architecture,
which is non-negotiable for autonomous operations.
Absolutely.
Switching gears to NoSQL, DynamoDB is often the default choice for hyperscale key value needs. The sources revisited the core concept with a classic analogy that really helps ground the complexity.
The phone book analogy remains the clearest way to explain DynamoDB's structure. The partition key is conceptualized as the specific phone book on the shelf, say, the book for Seattle. The sort key is the mechanism that sorts the entries inside that specific book, allowing for efficient range queries.
So this model forces developers to think about how data is distributed across physical partitions for fast, predictable retrieval.
It does. But once you understand that foundation, there's a professional level caveat that can trip up even experienced developers, the 10 GB limit.
This is a critical detail, especially for applications that require local secondary indexes or LSIs.
It is. If your table uses an LSI, the item collection, that's all items that share the same partition key, cannot exceed 10 GB.
And why is that?
The reason is architectural. An LSI requires all the index data, the equivalent of both the white pages and yellow pages data for that partition, to be co-resident within the same physical partition.
So if that collection exceeds 10 GB, DynamoDB can't guarantee that.
Exactly. It cannot guarantee the fundamental co-residency, and therefore the LSI access pattern fails. It forces careful partition key design from day one.
And modeling for hyperscale often requires creating complex indexes to support multiple access patterns. The sources detailed a new feature designed to address the complexity and storage cost of these complex indexes, synthetic GSIs.
Synthetic global secondary indexes are a massive quality of life and cost improvement.
How so?
Previously, if you needed a GSI based on a combination of attributes, perhaps combining a user's zip code and their account type, you had to write code that concatenated those two attributes into a new composite attribute on every single base table item.
Which meant more storage, more write capacity units consumed, and just increased complexity on the base table.
Exactly. With synthetic GSIs, you define the index based on the combined attributes, without needing to write to or update all the base table items.
The system handles the composition dynamically.
It does. This eliminates the increased storage and write complexity on the base table while still providing the necessary complex access patterns. It significantly simplifies the data modeling process for high-throughput agents.
Predictive sub-millisecond latency is vital for agents acting in real time. This puts the spotlight squarely on the caching layer, and specifically, the revolution being driven by Valky. The performance leap reported is just staggering.
It truly is. For years, the architecture of Redis, which Valky is based on, was constrained by a single primary thread model.
Right.
While this provided consistency, it meant that all I/O operations networking command execution had to wait in line behind that one thread, which limited throughput and caused latency variability under heavy load.
That's the classic choke point. So how did Valky 7.2 achieve a 230% performance improvement?
They moved to a multi-threaded I/O system. This allowed Valky to process network traffic and I/O operations in parallel across multiple CPU cores, dramatically increasing the overall throughput.
But the core data manipulation is still single-threaded for consistency.
Yes, that's the key. But the slow parts reading from the socket, writing back out, are now parallelized. That 230% improvement comes directly from reducing that variability and enabling parallel processing of thousands of concurrent client connections.
That addresses the speed and variability. What about efficiency and cost? Memory utilization is the single largest cost factor in caching systems.
Valky 8.1 focused heavily on memory optimization. They rolled out a completely new hash table design, which is fundamentally more efficient for modern CPUs.
How does that work?
In older designs, finding a data element in memory might require chasing four separate pointers. The new design optimizes lookups to be just one pointer down, resulting in massive efficiency gains because the data is more likely to reside within the CPU's fast L1 or L2 cache.
That low-level optimization is amazing. But the detail about Bloom filters reducing memory usage by 98%, that is almost unbelievable.
It sounds like magic, but it's practical applied computer science. Bloom filters allow the cache to efficiently test whether an element is probably in a set.
So if an agent requests data that isn't cached?
A traditional system must perform a potentially expensive database lookup, only to find the key doesn't exist.
A negative lookup, which wastes database capacity.
Exactly. With Bloom filters, the cache can quickly determine, no, this key is definitely not here. Don't even bother checking the database. One customer used this implementation to reduce their overall memory usage in the cache by 98%.
98%.
Because they stopped storing huge volumes of negative lookup results. And they achieved this with no material increase in their actual database load.
And tying all this performance back to the agentic architecture, ElastiCache Serverless is designed to remove the human capacity planning element entirely.
It just abstracts the complexity away. ElastiCache Serverless automatically handles the scaling. It can scale horizontally up to hundreds of nodes and is engineered to achieve millions of requests per second with guaranteed sub-millisecond latency.
So for an agent builder,
they simply consume the resource and the infrastructure meets the unpredictable demand curve.
Finally, we need to talk about PostgreSQL tuning. Even with DSQL offering serverless scale, optimizing complex queries remains necessary for the highest throughput relational workloads. The source has provided three highly effective real-world tuning techniques.
These are the surgical techniques that separate high-performing systems from average ones. The first involves query rewriting to handle function calls within predicates.
What's the specific problem here?
The problem is that the PostgreSQL query optimizer is highly effective, but it operates based on statistical assumptions and indexes. When it encounters a function call within a where clause, say where format date timestamp, 2025-01-01, it can't predict the output of that function.
So it can't trust any available index.
It can't. Because it can't predict the output, it cannot trust any available index that might apply to the timestamp column.
So it panics and falls back to a sequential full table scan.
Precisely. It ignores the index, leading to massive performance degradation. The solution is to rewrite the query strategically, using a select call or different structure. This makes the optimizer aware of the function's output, allowing it to correctly identify and use the optimal index.
Preventing that catastrophic full table scan.
Right. The second technique focuses on strategic indexing itself, the value of partial indexes.
This sounds like it's all about trade-offs.
It is. Traditional indexes are built on the entire table, but every time you modify any row in the table, the database has to update that entire index. In large tables, this slows down modifications significantly.
And if you only query a small subset of the data, most of that huge index is just wasted effort.
Correct. Partial indexes address this by only indexing a relevant subset of the rows, for example, only indexing active products where is active ECREO.
And what are the benefits?
Two things. First, it dramatically improves read performance for that highly queried subset, which is what agents often need. Second, and crucially, it reduces the performance degradation for modifications to the rest of the table, because the massive unnecessary index doesn't need updating when an inactive product is changed.
That is a very clever way to segment the performance impact. What was the final tuning guidance on plan stability?
Plan stability is essential in high-throughput production environments where consistent latency is required. Query optimizers are heuristic. They make decisions based on shifting statistics, temporary workload spikes.
So sometimes they get it wrong.
Sometimes the optimizer selects up a core execution plan that causes intermittent performance issues, even if a known good plan exists.
How do DBAs stop the optimizer from being too clever for its own good?
They manually intervene to approve an execution plan and lock it in. Database administrators can capture a known high-performing plan and instruct the system to use only that plan for a specific critical query.
So it overrides the optimizer.
It does. It overrides the optimizer's potential decision to choose an unstable or suboptimal path based on transient statistical shifts. This ensures predictable high performance.
It's clear the data layer is evolving into a self-optimizing system, but it still requires this detailed human expertise or agentic expertise to handle those corner cases, moving from performance to resilience and security. Scaling autonomous AI demands architectures built on absolute reliability, especially in highly regulated sectors. Let's start with enterprise modernization, specifically SAP RISE on AWS.
SAP RISE represents a significant model for managed services. It defines really clear responsibilities. It's a fully managed SAP landscape where AWS is responsible for the resilience and availability of the foundational cloud components.
The physical infrastructure, hardware, data centers.
Exactly. And then the customer, or SAP, handles the higher layers.
Like the OS and database.
Correct. SAP handles the operating system and database maintenance. For mission-critical SAT systems, resilience is non-negotiable, and the sources detail two specific levels of recovery point objective, or RPO, offered.
Let's unpack RPO, which is the maximum acceptable amount of data loss measured in time.
For mission-critical landscapes that demand zero data loss, the architecture uses multi-AZ synchronous replication. Every write to the primary database is instantaneously replicated to a secondary database in a different availability zone.
Before the transaction is even acknowledged.
Right. This results in zero RPO. The business accepts the slightly higher write latency in exchange for absolute data integrity.
And what if they need long-distance disaster recovery across separate geographical regions?
That requires asynchronous replication. Mm-hmm. Data is written locally first and then streamed to the secondary region. This significantly reduces write latency on the primary system and protects against regional failure.
But the RPO is measured in minutes.
Yes, reflecting the lag in the replication stream. The choice here is a business decision balancing cost, latency, and acceptable data loss.
The sources also mention maintaining specialized, often legacy, on-premises workloads using the Elastic VMware solution, or EVS.
EVS is essentially a simple way to bring your existing VMware environment into the cloud, running it directly on EC2 metal infrastructure, specifically i4i.metal instances running VCF 5.2.1.
So think of it like a premium colocation environment.
But with OpEx billing and the critical benefit of cloud elasticity.
What's the key architectural advantage beyond just migrating the servers?
The integration. These VMware-based workloads, managed through familiar tools like vCenter and NSX, now sit co-resident inside the customer's virtual private cloud, their VPC.
Which immediately enables secure, low-latency communication with native AWS services.
Exactly. You can connect your existing VMware workloads directly to a serverless DynamoDB table, an RDS instance or S3, eliminating the complex networking and security overhead associated with linking a purely on-premises, siloed infrastructure to the cloud.
Now we have to address the central security challenge of the agentic AI era, confidential computing. Mm. Traditional encryption protects data at rest and in transit, but what protects data when it's actively being processed in memory?
That is the final security boundary. Confidential computing protects data in use. The sources highlighted two distinct threat vectors we have to address.
Which are?
Protection from the cloud provider, AWS, and protection from the customer's own operators or other processes running on the same host.
How does the foundational Nitro system address that first vector protection from AWS operators?
The Nitro system is designed for natural isolation from the ground up. Oh. AWS abstracted all virtualization, networking, and storage functions onto custom hardware, the Nitro cards and the Nitro security chip.
So the host EC2 instance runs a minimal hypervisor.
It does. And crucially, this design ensures that AWS operators have no technical pathway, no management access, and therefore no access to the customer content running on Nitro-based EC2 instances. That isolation is the default baseline security.
That takes care of the cloud provider risk. But what if a customer needs isolation from their own administrators, say, running a highly sensitive decryption service?
That requires Nitro enclaves, which provide additional isolation within the customer's own EC2 instance. An enclave is a cryptographically isolated environment created from the parent instance's memory.
And it has no external network connectivity, no persistent storage.
And absolutely no administrator root user access.
So the sensitive data is decrypted and processed inside a black box, even inaccessible to the parent operating system's root user. How is trust established in that black box environment?
Through cryptographic attestation. Before any sensitive data or secrets are fed into the enclave, the system proves the identity and integrity of the code running inside it.
How does it do that?
By comparing a reference hash generated at build time with the runtime hashes of the code in the enclave. If those hashes match, cryptographic proof is generated and the connection is trusted. It's a chain of trust that establishes with mathematical certainty that the code being run is the code the operator intended and nothing else.
Shifting to network resilience, connectivity must be robust and secure for billions of agents communicating across the globe.
Flexibility is key. Customers require options for public and private IP4, IPv6 address spaces, including the ability to bring your own IPBYOIP address space to maintain network consistency during migration.
And for secure private connectivity to those essential AWS services like S3 or DynamoDB, we don't want agent traffic hitting the public internet if it doesn't need to.
That's handled by interface VPC endpoints, leveraging PrivateLink. This mechanism provisions an elastic network interface, an ENI, directly within the customer's own VPC.
And the CNI provides a secure private connection.
That runs entirely over the AWS backbone. It ensures that sensitive agent communication with data services bypasses the public internet completely, improving both security and latency predictability.
When it comes to managing security at scale like intrusion prevention or deep packet filtering, the sources mention two primary approaches for traffic inspection, dependent on the customer's existing technology stack.
Right. The first approach is for customers with existing investments in third-party firewall appliances. They use the AWS Gateway Load Balancer, which is engineered to insert these third-party appliances transparently into the network flow.
So it provides native load balancing and health checks for the firewall fleet.
Exactly. It routes the traffic to the firewall. The firewall does the inspection. Then the traffic returns to the load balancer, which sends it to the destination.
And the second option?
The second option is for customers preferring a native cloud solution, the AWS Network Firewall. This service provides deep packet inspection, filtering, and monitoring at scale, allowing security teams to focus entirely on defining rules and managing threats, rather than deploying and managing the underlying infrastructure of the firewall itself.
Resilience is proven when systems fail gracefully. For autonomous agents relying on messaging systems, the sources provided deep insight into two critical messaging patterns, the dead letter queue, or DLQ, and the circuit breaker.
The DLQ pattern is the first line of defense. If a consumer application fails to process a message repeatedly, perhaps due to a transient error, an unavailable service, or a schema mismatch, the message is routed to the DLQ.
This is crucial because it allows the rest of the system's behavior to get quickly under control.
It does. The failed messages are isolated, preventing message thrashing and giving administrators time to fix the underlying issue before manually redriving those specific orders later.
So the DLQ prevents the current problem from escalating. But the circuit breaker pattern prevents the problem from cascading across service boundaries.
Absolutely. The circuit breaker is critical for handling dependency failure. Before a message consumer attempts to retry a message, or before an administrator redries messages from the DLQ, the consumer must perform a canary check.
A health check on the downstream system. It tests the waters.
Yes. If that dependency is confirmed to be broken or unhealthy, the circuit immediately opens and all subsequent messages are sent directly to the DLQ without attempting processing.
So this prevents the consumer from wasting resources, pointlessly retrying.
And more importantly, it prevents the consumer from overwhelming and further degrading a known failed service, ensuring high availability and stability for the rest of the application.
Our final section must touch on governance, compliance, and cost optimization, which are intrinsically linked in the modern cloud architecture.
Managing compliance is a massive task, especially in regulated industries. It requires mapping complex external compliance frameworks, like the detailed requirements of PCI DSS 4.0 or the security benchmarks from CIS.
The Center for Internet Security.
To the specific managed controls offered by the cloud provider. Tools like Control Tower and Security Hub are used to automate the enforcement and monitoring of these controls,
providing detective and proactive protection across the entire environment.
Mm-hmm.
On the cost side, large-scale enterprise modernization often involves migrating existing software licenses. The sources detailed a program specifically aimed at reducing the capital expenditure, the CapEx, associated with legacy licensing.
That is the Optimization and Licensing Assessment Program, or OLA. Its core focus is helping customers determine the true financial picture of their existing license costs, particularly for complex software like Windows Server and SQL Server.
So it helps them decide if bringing their own license is actually the best option?
Exactly. It helps determine whether the BYOL model is actually the most cost-competitive option, or if the cloud provider's license-included offerings provide better long-term total cost of ownership.
And there was a remarkable, highly specific example given regarding cost savings on license-included Windows and SQL Server workloads that relies entirely on a deep understanding of core utilization and hyper-threading.
Yes, this detail is gold for our highly technical listeners.
This is where surgical optimization meets finance.
It is. For license-included SQL Server workloads, the cost is calculated based on the number of virtual CPUs, or vCPUs, allocated to the instance. A standard virtualized instance might present vCPUs using hyperthreading, meaning 8 vCPUs might only correspond to 4 physical cores.
But the license cost is tied to the vCPU count, so if you have an 8 vCPU instance, you pay for 8 licenses.
Exactly. The optimization involves leveraging the ability to disable hyperthreading at the instance level. A customer can take a running 8 vCPU SQL Server instance, stop it, disable hyperthreading, and reduce the reported vCPUs down to 4.
And because hyperthreading is disabled,
those 4 vCPUs still provide nearly the same physical core performance as the original 8 hyperthreaded vCPUs for that specific type of workload.
But the financial consequence is massive.
Absolutely. You achieve lower infrastructure costs, and more significantly, you reduce the license cost by 50%, paying for only 4 licenses instead of 8, without fundamentally sacrificing the workload capability.
Wow.
That level of optimization, from SQL query plans to licensing models, is indicative of the depth required to build the foundation for the agentic age.
That attention to detail, whether it's optimizing a core utilization setting or optimizing a caching lookup, is clearly the hallmark of building for this new era. We've covered monumental architectural shifts today. From the moment an idea enters a spec-driven environment like Quiro, through its deployment onto hyperscaling databases like Aurora, DSQL, and Valky, and secured by cryptographic isolation using Nitro enclaves, the underlying infrastructure is just fundamentally transforming.
The infrastructure required to run the future, from AI SREs autonomously patching production to managed SAP environments demanding zero data loss resilience, is defined by 3 core principles.
And those are?
Absolute control over data context, surgical specialization via MCP servers, and relentless automation.
Here's where it gets really interesting. What does this all mean for the human expert? We've seen agents accelerate processes that used to take hours, reducing vulnerability analysis and subsequent remediation down to mere minutes. We established that human governance must remain the constant.
Right. If the AI augments the expert and is grounded in trusted data, the human role shifts from execution to oversight and constraint definition.
Which is a huge shift.
It is. The system's speed is incredible, but it forces us to confront the fact that we are moving from worrying about manual mistakes to worrying about algorithmic mistakes or agent drift.
That brings us to our final provocative thought for you to consider as you reflect on these architectural changes. In an era defined by AI-driven operations and autonomous patching, where agents gain scale and agility every day, we must ask, what is the optimal level of human intervention required, not just to ensure safety and compliance with frameworks like PCI DSS, but to prevent the operational equivalent of stifling innovation? As agents become more capable and self-correcting, where must the human draw the line between necessary governance and the raw agility required to outpace competitors in the next generation of cloud architecture?